It went beyond anything that Senator Gerald P. Nye, dapper chairman and most radical member of the committee, ever thought of recommending. Staff researcher John Flynn laid it out for committee members, who met with the president to discuss it. Roosevelt surprised them by responding positively. Secretary of State Cordell Hull, however, advised Roosevelt against supporting any specific legislation eliminating war profits. But, given the president's backing, committee members decided to put their proposals into legislative form. The tentative provisions included a tax of 100% on all incomes over $10,000 and hefty taxes on lower incomes, a 50% tax on the first 6% of corporate profits, and 100% on profits over 6%, drafting corporate officials into the army, shuttering all stock exchanges for the duration of the war, prohibiting all commodity speculation, and commandeering of all essential industries and services. Flynn told the committee, "The profits in war, the spiraling of prices, the uncivilized scrambling for the shameful fruits of national disaster can be prevented in only one way, and that is to prevent inflation at the beginning. In 1917 and 1918, we had our war, and we sent our bill to our children and grandchildren. In the next war, we must resolve, as intelligent as well as civilized beings, that while one part of the population, the army, fights in the field, the other part, that stays at home, will pay the bills." The slightly amended Flynn proposal was introduced as the Emergency Wartime Act in early April. The bill would mandate government seizure of all profits above 3% and all individual earnings above $10,000. Nye commented, "The bill is drastic because war is a drastic thing. The tax collector who comes for one man's money is not nearly so solemn and forbidding as the draft officer who knocks at another man's door and calls for his young son." When the House was ready to vote on the more moderate McSwain bill, pandemonium broke out. Opposition rang down from all sides. The New York Times reported, "Anti-war sentiment so swept the House that the original McSwain proposal was amended beyond recognition." Amendments included an excess war profits tax of 100%, government control of the financial and material resources of the country, and conscripting officials in industry, commerce, transportation, and communications. The bill passed the House with provisions to draft all men between the ages of 21 and 45, but with conscription of management officials stripped out. The bill was framed so that it would be easy to add provisions from the more radical Nye bill in the final version. Arthur Kroc inveighed against both bills in the New York Times. "The McSwain bill," he charged, "is colored with pacifism. The Nye bill, with syndicalism, socialism, or communism. The two measures seek to discourage war by providing the certainty that the well-to-do would be ruined when war was declared. Only labor and passive objectors have been treated with consideration. All the provisions of the bills are designed to prevent limiting the wage or strikes of the one and the conscription of the other." Baruch also weighed in against features of the Nye bill, claiming it would increase inflation, paralyze war production, and leave the country defenseless against a major attack. Nye accused Baruch of being business's mouthpiece and not really wanting to eliminate war profits. Nye introduced his bill in the Senate in early May as an amendment to the McSwain war profits bill. He promised that this would be only the first of several bills to come out of his committee, explaining, "We believe the opinion of the American people is behind this bill. We think that now, when the whole world is troubled by rumors of wars, is the time to serve notice on our own people and on the world that America does not intend to use another war as an instrument to make a foolish and futile effort to make a few people rich." The committee presented three resolutions to the Senate. One prohibited making loans to warring nations or their citizens. A second denied passports to citizens entering war zones. And a third embargoed arms shipments to warring nations, if such shipments might involve the United States in conflicts. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee approved the first two measures, and was debating the third, when Hull convinced committee members to keep U.S. options open in dealing with other nations. With the developing Ethiopia crisis on their minds, they decided to reconsider all three measures before finalizing their actions. When Congress adjourned in September, the differences between the House and Senate versions of the War Profits Bill had not yet been resolved. That was a relief to the Chicago Tribune, which called it a communistic defense act, that in the event of war would allow the president to communize the American nation as completely as Lenin communized Russia. At that point, with pressure building for dramatic action, Wilson's former Secretary of War, Newton Baker, threw a monkey wrench into the proceedings. He responded to a letter to the New York Times by William Floyd, the head of Peace Patriots, by denying that there had been any discussion of protecting private U.S. commercial or financial interests in the run-up to the United States' entry into the World War, and averred that America's safety from future wars cannot be secured by muzzling bankers or disabling munitions makers. 4 days later, banker Thomas Lamont wrote, challenging Floyd's evidence and blaming German aggression, not U.S. commercial interests, for U.S. entry. These very issues formed the crux of renewed committee investigations in early 1936. Was it true that the House of Morgan and other Wall Street firms had pushed the United States to war in order to recoup the enormous sums they had lent to the Allies? Both sides readied for the battle. The much-anticipated showdown occurred on January 7th, when J.P. Morgan appeared before the committee, along with his partners Lamont and George Whitney, as well as Frank Vanderlip, a former president of National City Bank. John W. Davis came along as Morgan's counsel. The committee moved the hearings to the caucus room of the Senate office building in order to accommodate the record number of requests for seats. Nye committee researchers had been poring over the books and files of the banking behemoth for almost a year, examining more than 2 million letters, telegrams, and other documents. The night before the hearings, the firm invited reporters to its 40-room suite at the Shoreham Hotel for an off-the-record background briefing by Lamont and Whitney. Nye took to the radio to lay out his position to a national audience. After we had started stretching our American neutrality policy to accommodate commercial interests to the extent of permitting loans, he reasoned, the Allied powers were never in doubt as to what America would ultimately do. They knew what we didn't seem to realize, namely that where our pocketbook was, there would we and our hearts ultimately be. Morgan released a 9-page statement denying such allegations. It read, "We call particular attention to the secured nature of these loans, because there has been an impression fostered in certain quarters to the effect that the Allied loans were worthless unless America entered the war, that the holders of these loans urged our government into the war to make the loans good. There was nothing in the facts remotely justifying this fantastic theory. The loans were always good. No one feared for their safety." The statement argued that U.S. business was already thriving from supplying the Allies, and there was no material advantage to having the United States enter the war. Losing the debate could have enormous consequences. Nye and Clark recognized that the evidence presented about U.S. entry into the past war could determine the fate of the important neutrality bill they were introducing that week. At that first hearing, the committee released documents showing that President Wilson had sided with Secretary of War Robert Lansing over Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan's sharp opposition and decided to allow bankers to float loans to belligerents in 1914, long before the policy change was publicly announced. Before adjourning, Senator Clark asked one last question of Vanderlip. "Do you think Great Britain would have paid her debts if she had lost the war?" Vanderlip replied, "Yes, even had she lost the war, she would have paid." In subsequent hearings, Nye and other committee members endeavored to show that the United States had never been neutral in the war, and that German submarine warfare was just the pretext Wilson seized upon as an excuse to intervene. Nye dropped one last bombshell. He alleged that Wilson learned about the Allies' secret treaties before the United States entered the war, and then falsified the record by telling members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that he had found this out only later at Versailles. The Nye Committee investigations showed that Wilson had, in effect, lied the country into war. He had undermined neutrality by allowing loans and other support to the Allies, deliberately exaggerated claims of German atrocities, and covered up the fact of his knowledge of the secret treaties. Far from being a war to further democracy, it had been a war to redivide the spoils of empire. Aspersions on the integrity of Woodrow Wilson proved to be the final straw for many Senate Democrats, who rose in fevered denunciations of the committee chairman in what the Washington Post described as a tornado of protest and resentment. Senator Tom Connally of Texas led the charge, declaring, "I do not care how the charges were made. They are infamous. Some checker-playing, beer-drinking back room of some low house is the only place fit for the kind of language the senator from North Dakota, the chairman of the committee, this man who is going to lead us out toward peace, puts into the record about a dead man, a great man, a good man, and a man who, when alive, had the courage to meet his enemies face to face and eye to eye." Connally accused Nye and the committee of an almost scandalous effort to besmear and besmut the records of America in the World War. The controversy split the committee itself. Two of the members, Senators Pope and George, left the hearing in protest. Pope returned and read a statement in which he and Gregory expressed resentment at any effort to impugn the motives of Woodrow Wilson and to discredit his great character. They regretted that the purpose of the investigation was being lost sight of, and feared that the chance of securing remedial legislation was slipping away. They questioned the integrity of the committee's investigation. Such efforts to disparage Wilson and Lansing disclose the bias and prejudice with which the investigation is being carried on. They made it clear that they were not resigning from the committee and would return for a vote on the final report. Another committee member, Senator Vandenberg, added that he too admired Wilson, but that economic motives had provided an inevitable and irresistible impulse for getting the United States into the war. He wanted to make sure that never happened again, and said he took pride in what the committee had accomplished. "History has been rewritten in the last 48 hours. It is important that history should be revealed in all its nakedness, no matter what it shows." Nye assured Pope and George that he had no malice toward Wilson, and had even voted for him in 1916, promising to persevere, as long as there is a possibility of lessening the chances of our being drawn into war. The bloodletting continued the next day in the Senate. 78-year-old Carter Glass of Virginia, who had served as Wilson's Secretary of the Treasury in the last months of his administration, accused Nye of an infamous libel, an unspeakable accusation against a dead president, dirt-daubing the sepulcher of Woodrow Wilson. Pounding his hand on the desk so hard that blood spurted all over his papers, Carter cried out, "Oh, the miserable demagogy, the miserable and mendacious suggestion that the House of Morgan altered the neutrality course of Woodrow Wilson." Nye finally got his chance to respond on the floor of the Senate. He said that what surprised him was that there had not been an earlier concerted effort to stop his committee's work, and that the hostility only became apparent with the appearance of Morgan and his partners. He offered no apologies, instead reading letters and documents that, he reiterated, showed that the United States entered the war knowing the spoils had been agreed upon. Yet we were told news of secret treaties came as a bombshell at the peace conference. 2 days later, Nye informed Morgan and his partners that they need not appear as scheduled the following week for further examination. The committee had hit a roadblock, and the prospects of Senate appropriation of the $9,000 needed to continue its work looked bleak. He accused his detractors of using the Wilson issue as a smokescreen. Their real intention, he insisted, was to seize upon any weapon and resort to any subterfuge to kill legislation which threatens the bloody profits to be made from war. To everyone's surprise and Nye's delight, the hearings were not aborted. On January 30th, the Senate unanimously approved $7,369 to finish the probe. Even Connolly reversed his previous position and voted for the added funding, but he urged the committee to stick to living people and not invade the cemeteries and catacombs of the dead. The New York Times explained the Senate's change of heart. When Wilsonians resentful of slurs against their World War chieftain threatened to interrupt the inquiry by stripping it of funds, mail sacks on Capitol Hill bulged with letters urging that the full story of 1914 to 18 be told. That demonstration of an anti-war mood explains why an inquiry, which had provoked more bitterness than any similar affair in many years, was allowed to survive. The Times credited the committee with having already achieved notable reforms. It helped to place on the books a statute requiring munitions makers to obtain licenses and report all shipments to the State Department. It resulted in the framing of bills to remove exorbitant profits from the arms and shipbuilding industries, and it is expected that these proposals will eventually become law in one form or another. But its major accomplishment is the churning of public opinion on the subject of war, peace, and profits. During the final sessions, representatives of the House of Morgan did their best to fend off charges that their loans to the Allies had influenced U.S. participation in the war. The New York Times headlined its February 5th article, "Morgan Leaves Happy, Cleared by Friend Nye." The Times breathed a sigh of relief. It titled its February 9th editorial, "An Inquiry Ends Well." The committee's efforts to show that Morgan had made enormous profits out of the sale of munitions and had used its powerful influence to secure American entry were completely discredited, the Times noted, and the inquiry ended on a sort of jovial note of congratulation between Mr. Morgan and his friend Nye. The editorial concluded, "Such an outcome is of great public benefit. It is easy to imagine the disturbing effect if a contrary result had been reached. People would despairingly have concluded that there was something rotten in the whole banking business." Nye immediately took issue with the Times' portrayal. "There is not a single member of the Senate Committee of Inquiry that believes that the inquiry has afforded a clean bill of health for the banking house of Morgan." Although Morgan couldn't be blamed for inducing U.S. entry into the war to protect its investments, Nye noted that it was altogether fair to say that these bankers were in the heart and center of a system that made our going to war inevitable. Once Wilson allowed Morgan to become banker to the Allies, Nye added, "the road to war was paved and greased for us." Dramatic evidence that the committee hearings were having the desired impact appeared in a Gallup poll released on March 7th. When asked, "Should the manufacture and sale of war munitions for private profit be prohibited?" 82% of Americans responded yes, and only 18% no. The strongest support came from Nevada, where 99% favored abolishing profits. The weakest came from Delaware, the home of DuPont, where only 63% answered affirmatively. George Gallup reported that since the company had begun polling the previous October, only old age pensions had received more support in any of its surveys. Gallup quoted a grocer in western Pennsylvania who said, "The profit system in munitions has been leading us to war for generations." Even Nye had considered such ideas far-fetched when he began his hearings 17 months earlier. "I thought," he admitted, "that nationalization of munitions manufacturers was about the wildest idea we had under consideration." The Washington Post, among others, congratulated Nye and his committee for educating the public on the abuses which have developed in the munitions trade and the relation between war and the accessibility of arms. The next day, Eleanor Roosevelt, speaking in Grand Rapids, Michigan, called for taking all profits out of the munitions industry. The New York Times, which had so recently come to the defense of Morgan and the munitions manufacturers, did not even report that the Gallup poll had been released. In April, the Nye Committee issued its long-awaited third report. It concluded, While the evidence before this committee does not show that wars have been started solely because of the activities of munitions makers and their agents, it is also true that wars rarely have one single cause, and the committee finds it to be against the peace of the world for selfishly interested organizations to be left free to goad and frighten nations into military activity. Four of the seven members of the committee, Nye, Clark, Pope, and Bone, called for outright government ownership of the munitions industry. The minority, George, Barber, and Vandenberg, called for rigid and conclusive munitions control. But the bill to remove the profits from war had been assigned to a subcommittee chaired by Connolly, one of Nye's biggest critics. There it languished, and when it was finally introduced in watered-down form, it failed to get the requisite votes. Similar bills introduced by Nye and others over the next 5 years also failed to gain traction. Among the issues raised by the hearings that continue to rankle investigators is U.S. businessmen's contribution to Germany's economic and military revitalization long after they had become aware of the repugnant nature of Hitler's regime. Since 1933, Hitler had been imprisoning and murdering communists, social democrats, and labor leaders. His vicious anti-Semitism was apparent, although the campaign to exterminate the Jews was still several years away. Close ties between U.S. businessmen and bankers and their German counterparts had been forged in the years prior to Hitler's rise to power. U.S. loans, largely organized by the Morgan and Chase banking interests, propped up the faltering German economy of the 1920s. IBM, headed by Thomas Watson, purchased a controlling interest in the German firm Dehomag. Sloan's General Motors purchased German car manufacturer Adam Opel between 1929 and 1931. Ford increased investment in its German subsidiary, Ford Motor Company Aktiengesellschaft, declaring that this move would build a bridge between countries. Watson shared that vision. World peace through world trade, he was fond of proclaiming. World peace, however noble, was no more the capitalist's primary concern than was achieving wealth and power through a competitive marketplace. Through a dizzying array of formal and informal business agreements, a network of multinational corporations based in the United States, England, and Germany colluded to capture markets and control prices. A trade agreement reached in Dusseldorf between the Federation of British Industries and Reichsgrupp Industry was announced in March 1939, proclaiming, "It is agreed that it is essential to replace destructive competition, wherever it may be found, by constructive cooperation designed to foster world trade, to the mutual benefit of Great Britain, Germany, and all other countries." It was only after the war that most observers became aware how extensive such arrangements had been. As Theodore Krepps of Stanford University observed in May 1945, the word cartel has recently been catapulted from the obscure technical jargon of economic treatises to the front pages of daily newspapers. Typical of these arrangements, Edsel Ford sat on the board of the German chemical firm IG Farben's U.S. subsidiary, General Aniline and Film, while Farben general manager Carl Bosch sat on the board of Ford's European subsidiary. Similar arrangements tied together Farben, DuPont, GM, Standard Oil, and Chase Bank. After meeting Hitler in 1937, Watson dutifully and credulously relayed the Führer's message to a gathering of the International Chamber of Commerce in Berlin. "There will be no war. No country wants war. No country can afford it." A few days later, on his 75th birthday, he accepted the Grand Cross of the German Eagle, which Hitler bestowed on him for the welcome assistance that Dehomag's punch card machines were providing the German government in tabulating its 1930 census and, as a result, identifying Jews. Dehomag's counting machines represented an unprecedented breakthrough in the organization of data that later, when the company was under Nazi control, helped make the trains to Auschwitz run on time. Henry Ford also attested to Hitler's pacific intentions. On August 28, 1939, just 4 days prior to the invasion of Poland, Ford assured the Boston Globe that Hitler was just bluffing. "The Germans don't dare have a war and they know it," he said. A week later, after the German invasion had begun, he had the temerity to remark to a friend, "There hasn't been a shot fired. The whole thing has just been made up by Jew bankers." Ford and Watson should both have known better. In 1937, Ford's German subsidiary was manufacturing heavy trucks and troop carriers for the German Wehrmacht. In July 1939, the subsidiary changed its name to Fordwerk. Farben, which was later convicted of crimes against humanity for operating the Buna rubber plant at Auschwitz and supplying the notorious Zyklon B tablets used to exterminate Jews, owned 15% of the company. When the war started in 1939, Ford and GM still controlled their German subsidiaries, which dominated the German auto industry. Despite their subsequent disclaimers, they refused to divest themselves of their German holdings and even complied with German government orders to retool for war production, while resisting similar demands from the U.S. government to retool their factories at home. Sloan justified such behavior in March 1939, following the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia, based on the fact that the German operations were highly profitable. Germany's internal politics, he insisted, should not be considered the business of the management of General Motors. Opel converted the 432-acre complex in Rüsselsheim to production of Luftwaffe warplanes, providing fully 50% of the propulsion systems for Germany's Ju-88 medium-range bombers, while also helping to develop the world's first jet fighter, the ME-262, which was capable of speeds 100 miles per hour faster than the United States' P-510 Mustangs. In appreciation of their efforts, the Nazi government decorated Henry Ford with the Grand Cross of the German Eagle in 1938, 4 months after Germany had annexed Austria, and similarly honored James D. Mooney, GM's chief overseas executive, 1 month later. Ford's parent company lost effective control of the company during the war years, when Fordwerk supplied the regime with arms, employing prisoners from nearby Buchenwald concentration camp as slave labor. When a former prisoner, Elsa Ivanova, brought suit against the company in 1998, the Ford Motor Company hired a small army of researchers and lawyers to whitewash its unscrupulous behavior and promote its preferred image as part of the arsenal of democracy. Just after the war, however, a report by U.S. Army investigator Henry Schneider called Fordwerk an arsenal of Nazism. And, as Bradford Snell discovered during his congressional investigation into the monopolistic practices of the auto industry, through their multinational dominance of motor vehicle production, GM and Ford became principal suppliers for the forces of fascism, as well as for the forces of democracy. Henry Ford did more than supply trucks for the German military. He also helped the Nazis hone their hateful ideology. In 1921, he published a collection of anti-Semitic articles titled "The International Jew," which was widely read by future Nazi leaders. He also sponsored the printing of 500,000 copies of The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The fact that the protocols had been widely exposed as a forgery didn't deter Ford. Baldur von Schirach, former head of the Hitler Youth Organization and wartime governor of Nazi-occupied Vienna, testified at Nuremberg, "The decisive anti-Semitic book which I read at that time was Henry Ford's book, The International Jew. I read it and became anti-Semitic. This book made a great impression on my friends and myself, because we saw in Henry Ford the representative of success, also the representative of a progressive social policy. In the poverty-stricken and wretched Germany of the time, youth looked toward America, and it was Henry Ford who, to us, represented America. If he said Jews were to blame, naturally we believed him." Hitler hung a portrait of Ford in his Munich office and confided to a Chicago Tribune reporter in 1923, "I wish I could send some of my shock troops to Chicago and other big American cities to help in the elections. We look on Heinrich Ford as the leader of the growing fascist party in America." In 1931, he told readers of the Detroit News, "I regard Henry Ford as my inspiration." The Germans also drew inspiration from the ill-fated U.S. flirtation with eugenics and racial hygiene in the 1920s and 1930s. California paved the way in forced sterilizations, with more than a third of the 60,000 performed, but other states were not far behind. Rockefeller and Carnegie money helped fund the research that gave these efforts a patina of respectability. These developments did not go unnoticed in Germany. In Mein Kampf, Hitler lauded American leadership in the field of eugenics. He later informed his Nazi colleagues, "I have studied with great interest the laws of several American states concerning prevention of reproduction by people whose progeny would, in all probability, be of no value or be injurious to the racial stock." Among those states was Virginia, whose decision to sterilize a feeble-minded young woman prompted the famous 1927 Supreme Court ruling in the case of Buck v. Bell. In writing the majority opinion, 86-year-old Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, a Civil War veteran, argued that Buck's sacrifice of procreative freedom was comparable to soldiers sacrificing their lives in wartime. "We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices, in order to prevent our being swamped with incompetence." Holmes concluded, "It is better for the entire world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime, or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough." Although Virginia was second only to California in forced sterilizations, some felt it was not aggressive enough. In pushing the state legislature to broaden its sterilization law, Dr. Joseph Desjarnets complained in 1934, "The Germans are beating us at our own game." Although most U.S. companies doing business in Hitler's Germany removed American officials in 1939 or 1940, control often remained in the hands of the same German businessmen who had run the companies as subsidiaries of U.S. firms. Profits, meanwhile, piled up in blocked bank accounts. Prominent among the American capitalists with ties to Nazi counterparts was Prescott Bush, the father of one president and grandfather of another. Researchers have been trying for years to determine the precise nature of Bush's ties to Fritz Thyssen, the wealthy German industrialist who played a crucial role in bankrolling Hitler, as revealed in his 1941 memoirs, I Paid Hitler. Thyssen ultimately repudiated the Nazi dictator and was himself imprisoned. While incarcerated, Thyssen's vast wealth was protected overseas, much of it by the investment firm of Brown Brothers Harriman, through the holding company Union Banking Corporation. The account was managed by senior partner Prescott Bush. In 1942, the U.S. government seized Union Banking Corporation under the Trading with the Enemy Act for its association with the Thyssen-owned bank Voorhandel en Scheepvaart NV of Rotterdam. The government also seized four other Thyssen-linked companies whose accounts Bush handled: the Holland-American Trading Company, the Seamless Steel Equipment Corporation, the Silesian American Corporation, and the Hamburg America Line Shipping Company. Following the war, most of this Nazi-tainted money was released. Union Banking Corporation shares were returned to Bush. Dehomag's frozen profits were taken by IBM, and Ford and GM both reabsorbed their German subsidiaries. even receiving reparations for the European factories that had been destroyed by Allied bombing, up to $33 million in the case of GM. These businessmen were not alone. Many American companies continued doing business with Nazi Germany right up to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. As Ford Motor Company was happy to point out in its 2001 investigation into the activities of Fordwerk, at the start of the war, 250 American firms owned more than $450 million worth of German assets, with 58.5% being owned by the top 10. Among the companies were familiar names like Standard Oil, Woolworth, IT&T, Singer, International Harvester, Eastman Kodak, Gillette, Coca-Cola, Kraft, Westinghouse, and United Fruit. Ford ranked 16th, holding only 1.9% of the total U.S. investment. Standard Oil and GM topped the list, holding 14 and 12% respectively. Many of these companies were represented by the corporate powerhouse law firm Sullivan & Cromwell, headed by future Secretary of State John Foster Dulles. His brother, Alan Dulles, future head of the CIA, was a partner. Among their clients was the Bank for International Settlements, BIS, which had been set up in Switzerland in 1930 to channel war reparations between the United States and Germany. After war was declared, the bank continued to offer financial services to the Third Reich. The majority of gold looted during the Nazi conquests of Europe ended up in BIS vaults, and the transfer of capital allowed the Nazis access to money that would have been normally trapped in blocked accounts under the Trading with the Enemy Act. Several Nazis and supporters were involved at high levels, including Hjalmar Schacht and Walther Funk, who both ended up in the dock at the Nuremberg trials, though Schacht was acquitted. American lawyer and chairman of the bank, Thomas McKittrick, facilitated the process, claiming neutrality, but effectively aiding the Nazis. The BIS's operations were so vile that Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, charged that 12 of the bank's 14 directors were Nazi or Nazi-controlled. Chase, Morgan, Union Bank, and the Bank for International Settlements all managed to obfuscate their collaboration with the Nazis. Chase continued to work with Vichy France, a client state and intermediary of the Third Reich. Its deposits doubled during the war years. In 1998, Holocaust survivors sued the bank, claiming it held blocked accounts from that era. While American capitalists piled up the earnings from their overseas investments and did everything possible to ingratiate themselves to the German government, Gerald Nye and his crack team of investigators succeeded brilliantly in revealing sordid truths about the influence and machinations of arms manufacturers and moneylenders, exposing the ugly reality hidden beneath the lofty refrains to which the GIs had marched off to war. But the hearings had two other effects that, with the wisdom of hindsight, we can justly regret. First, they tended to oversimplify the causes of the war. And second, they reinforced the country's isolationist tendencies at precisely the worst time imaginable, when U.S. influence might have helped avert disaster. The hearings justified the widespread belief that the United States should steer clear of entangling alliances and involvement in world affairs. For perhaps the only time in U.S. history, powerful anti-war sentiment was actually misplaced in light of the true threat to humanity posed by fascistic and other dangerous forces. Cordell Hull later wrote that the Nye Committee hearings had had the disastrous effects of catalyzing an isolationist sentiment that was to tie the hands of the administration just at the time when our hands should have been free to place the weight of our influence in the scales where it would count. In January 1935, Christian Century observed, 99 Americans out of 100 would today regard as an imbecile anyone who might suggest that, in the event of another European war, the United States should again participate in it. Events in Europe would soon prompt some to reconsider. First, Hitler repudiated the arms limitations imposed at Versailles. Then, in October 1935, Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. Hampered by recently passed neutrality legislation, imposing an embargo on arms sales to all belligerents, and a domestic population whose loyalties were sharply divided, with Italian Americans generally supporting Mussolini and African Americans supporting Ethiopia, the United States stayed on the sidelines. Nor did the international community strongly condemn the invasion. The League of Nations denounced the Italian aggression and looked to impose an oil embargo with potentially devastating consequences. The League's Coordination Committee asked non-member nations if they would comply. At the time, the United States supplied more than half the world's oil. U.S. cooperation could have done much to deter fascist aggression. But Roosevelt, bowing to the isolationist sentiment at home, opted not to participate. Roosevelt instead announced a moral embargo on shipments of oil and other important resources. The moral embargo proved completely ineffectual, as U.S. resource shipments to Italy nearly tripled over the next few months. The League passed limited and toothless sanctions that it watered down out of deference to British and French timidity and fear of provoking Italy. Mussolini's gambit succeeded. Hitler and the Japanese concluded that Great Britain, France, and the United States had no stomach for war and would rather acquiesce than face military action. In January 1936, Japan walked out of the London Naval Conference and began an ambitious militarization program. In March 1936, German troops occupied the Rhineland. It was both Hitler's big gamble and his big bluff, but it worked. He later admitted that armed resistance would have forced him to back down. "The 48 hours after the march into the Rhineland were the most nerve-wracking in my life," he said. "If the French had then marched into the Rhineland, we would have had to withdraw with our tails between our legs, for the military resources at our disposal would have been wholly inadequate for even a moderate resistance." The feeble international response to the Spanish Civil War was even more disheartening. Fighting broke out in July 1936 as Francisco Franco's forces set out to topple the elected Spanish government and establish a fascist regime. The Republic had made enemies among U.S. officials and corporate leaders by its progressive policies and tight regulation of business. Some alleged communist influence and expressed fear that a Republican victory would result in a communist domination. American Catholics and church officials, angered by the Republic's aggressive anti-clericalism, rallied to Franco's support, as did Hitler and Mussolini, who provided abundant aid, including aircraft, pilots, and thousands of troops. Germany would use the war to test the weapons and tactics it later deployed against Poland and the rest of Europe. Stalin sent planes and tanks to the Democratic forces, but couldn't come close to matching the massive assistance from Berlin and Rome. But Roosevelt did nothing to assist the Republican forces, nor did Great Britain or France. The United States, following the British and French lead, banned the shipment of weapons to both sides, which weakened the beleaguered and outgunned government forces. Ford, GM, Firestone, and other U.S. businesses provided the fascists with trucks, tires, and machine tools. Texaco Oil Company, headed by pro-fascist Colonel Thorkild Reber, promised Franco all the oil he needed, on credit. Roosevelt, furious, threatened an oil embargo and slapped Texaco with a fine. But Reber persisted undeterred, supplying oil to Hitler and being lionized in the pages of Life magazine. Progressive Americans rallied to the Republican cause. Surprisingly to some, it was anti-war stalwart Gerald Nye who led the Senate fight to send desperately needed arms to Republican forces. Some 3,000 brave American volunteers went to Spain to battle the fascists, traveling first to France and then sneaking across the Pyrenees into Spain. 450 men formed the legendary communist-backed Abraham Lincoln Brigade, which suffered 120 dead and 175 wounded. Paul Robeson, the extraordinarily talented African-American athlete, intellectual, actor, and singer, went to the battlefield to entertain the troops. The fighting dragged on for 3 years. The Republic fell in spring 1939, burying with it not only over 100,000 Republican soldiers and 5,000 foreign volunteers, but the hopes and dreams of much of humanity. By 1938, Roosevelt realized how foolish his policies had been and tried to send covert aid to the Republic. It was too little, too late. His policy had been a grave mistake, Roosevelt told his cabinet. He warned that they would soon all pay the price. The world did little to impede Japanese aggression in China in 1937, though many onlookers were horrified at the reports of the fighting. Beginning with the Marco Polo Bridge incident in July 1937, fighting spread to other parts of the country. With Chiang Kai-shek's forces fleeing in retreat, Japan brutalized Chinese civilians. The atrocities, including an orgy of rape, looting, and murder, were most egregious in Shanghai and Nanjing. With fascistic and militaristic forces on the march, the world was hurtling rapidly toward war. Motivated in some cases by sympathy for the fascists, in others by hatred of Soviet communism, and in others by fear of plunging into the same abyss that had caused such suffering in the previous World War, the Western democracies stood on the sidelines as Italy, Japan, and Germany set about to forcibly change the balance of global power. Chapter 3. World War II. Who really defeated Germany? Most Americans view World War II nostalgically as the Good War, in which the United States and its allies triumphed over German Nazism, Italian fascism, and Japanese militarism. The rest of the world remembers it as the bloodiest war in human history. By the time it was over, more than 60 million people lay dead, including 27 million Russians, between 10 and 20 million Chinese, 6 million Jews, 5.5 million Germans, 3 million non-Jewish Poles, 2.5 million Japanese, and 1.5 million Yugoslavs. Austria, Great Britain, France, Italy, Hungary, Romania, and the United States each counted between 250,000 and 333,000 dead. Unlike World War I, World War II began slowly and incrementally. The opening shots were fired in 1931, when Japan's Kwantung Army overwhelmed Chinese forces in Manchuria. While the Western powers expanded their colonial empires in the late 19th century, the rapidly modernizing and industrializing Japan sought its proper place among the world's leading nations. Japan demonstrated its new military prowess by defeating China in the Sino-Japanese War of 1894 to 1895, and then delivering a stunning defeat to Russia in the Russo-Japanese War exactly a decade later. It was the first time in almost 700 years, since the days of Genghis Khan, that an Eastern power had defeated a Western one. The loss devastated the Russian regime, sparking a revolutionary upsurge in 1905. This radical ferment, fueled by Tsarist injustice and heavy losses to Germany in World War I, would culminate in the Russian Revolution in 1917. The Russo-Japanese War also created a bitterness between Russia and Japan that would fester for decades. Meanwhile, Germany, thirsting to avenge its own devastating defeat in World War I, was on the march in the West. Hitler and Mussolini formed the Axis in 1936 and began assisting General Francisco Franco's overthrow of the Spanish Republic. The Western democracies' spineless response to fascist aggression in Ethiopia and Spain emboldened Hitler to believe that he could pursue his plans to conquer the rest of Europe. It also convinced Stalin that Great Britain, France, and the United States had no interest in taking collective action to slow the Nazi advance. In 1937, full-scale war erupted in China as the powerful Japanese army captured city after city. In December 1937, Japanese soldiers brutalized the citizens of Nanjing, killing 200,000 to 300,000 civilians and raping perhaps 80,000 women. Japan soon controlled the east coast of China, with its population of 200 million. The international situation deteriorated further in 1938, when the Germans annexed Austria and the Allies capitulated to Hitler at Munich, giving Germany the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain infamously proclaimed that the settlement had brought peace in our time. Roosevelt knew better. The British and French, he insisted, had abandoned the helpless Czechs and would wash the blood from their Judas Iscariot hands. But Roosevelt also knew that the United States itself was offering little support to those who wanted to stand up to the Nazi dictator. Nor did the United States do enough to help Germany and Austria's desperate Jewish communities. In 1939, the United States admitted its full quota of 27,300 German and Austrian immigrants, the only year in which it did so. But with hundreds of thousands of Jews seeking refuge, U.S. assistance proved woefully inadequate, and Roosevelt made no effort to raise the low quota established by discriminatory immigration legislation in 1924. Hitler struck again in March 1939, invading Czechoslovakia. Stalin understood that the Soviet Union's turn was coming soon. For years, the Soviet dictator had implored the West to unite against Hitler and Mussolini. The Soviet Union even joined the League of Nations in 1934. But Soviet pleas for collective security against the fascist aggressors were repeatedly ignored. Following Hitler's assault on Czechoslovakia, Stalin again urged England and France to join in defense of Eastern Europe. His entreaties fell on deaf ears. Fearing a German-Polish alliance to attack the USSR, he decided to buy time. In August, he struck an unsavory deal with his mortal enemy. Hitler and Stalin shocked the world by signing a non-aggression pact with a secret protocol dividing Eastern Europe between them. In fact, the Soviet dictator had proposed a similar alliance with Britain and France, but neither would accept Stalin's demand to place Soviet troops on Polish soil as a way of maximizing the deterrent effect. Hitler invaded Poland on September 1st. The Allies declared war on Germany. The Soviet Union invaded Poland on September 17th. The Soviets soon thereafter asserted control over the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and invaded Finland. After a brief respite, in April 1940, Hitler unleashed his furious blitzkrieg. In rapid succession, Denmark, Norway, Holland, and Belgium all fell. On June 22nd, France, its younger generation having been decimated in World War I and its conservative ruling class anti-Semitic to the core, surrendered after only 6 weeks of fighting, leaving Great Britain isolated. During the Battle of Britain in summer 1940, prospects looked bleak. But Germany's failure to destroy Great Britain's Royal Air Force made the cross-channel invasion of Great Britain, planned for September 1940, impossible. Still, the German Luftwaffe's pummeling of British cities continued. Roosevelt wanted to help, but with neutrality legislation on the books, military preparedness at a low level, and isolationist sentiment running high, there was little he could do. He also encountered resistance from cabinet members and military leaders who thought that Great Britain was lost and resources should be concentrated on defending the homeland. He maneuvered to get Great Britain as much military aid as he could. Opening himself up to attacks that he was acting illegally, he bypassed the Senate and unilaterally decided to provide Great Britain with 50 old naval destroyers in exchange for 99-year leases of air and naval bases on 8 British possessions in the Western Hemisphere. As the Battle of Britain raged on, Roosevelt was willing to absorb such a tax to bolster British resolve. World leaders condemned Japanese aggression, but did little to help China, as Japan relentlessly bombed Chinese cities. In July 1939, the United States tightened the noose around the Japanese economy by terminating its 1911 commercial treaty with Japan, which cut off the flow of vital raw materials, and banning U.S. exports critical to the Japanese war machine. Meanwhile, in Manchuria, Soviet and Japanese armies battled over the disputed border, leading to Soviet General Georgi Zhukov's first victory, and heightening tensions in the east. In September 1940, Germany, Italy, and Japan formally concluded the Tripartite Pact, establishing the Axis Powers Alliance. Hungary, Romania, Slovakia, and Bulgaria joined soon thereafter. Seeing the war clouds gathering on the horizon, Roosevelt decided to break with precedent and run for a third term. The Republicans nominated a corporate attorney from Indiana, Wendell Willkie, a political moderate who supported much of the New Deal legislation and advocated military aid to Great Britain. The fact that Willkie, a recent convert to the Republican Party, had garnered the nomination angered party diehards like former Senator James Watson, who commented, "If a whore repented and wanted to join the church, I'd personally welcome her and lead her up the aisle to a pew. But by the eternal, I'd not ask her to lead the choir the first night." Roosevelt gave serious thought to choosing a running mate. The stakes were high. The nation might soon be at war. He weighed his options and chose his Secretary of Agriculture, Henry A. Wallace. He knew that there would be strong opposition to Wallace, who came from a line of prominent Iowa Republicans. His grandfather had founded Wallace's Farmer, a leading farm journal dedicated to scientific agriculture. His father served as Secretary of Agriculture under Harding and Coolidge until his death in 1924. Although he supported Smith in 1928 and Roosevelt in 1932, Wallace didn't officially switch parties until 1936, leading some party officials to question his loyalty, much as Republicans were questioning Willkie's. Roosevelt had no such doubts. He knew where Wallace stood on the issues. Wallace had been a stalwart as Secretary of Agriculture, overseeing an extraordinary return to agricultural prosperity. Farmers, who still constituted a quarter of the population in 1933, were in miserable shape when Wallace became Secretary. Production of farm commodities had flooded the markets, driving down prices. The problem, which persisted throughout the 1920s, reached crisis proportions after 1929. Total farm income in 1932 stood at one-third of what it had been in 1929. By 1933, desperation stalked rural America. Roosevelt understood that the overall success of the New Deal depended on the restoration of farm prosperity. Wallace's solution proved extremely controversial. He proposed paying farmers to reduce agricultural production on the assumption that lowered supply would increase demand and thereby raise prices. But in 1933, he was forced to take even more drastic action. The price of cotton had dropped to 5 cents per pound. Warehouses were bursting. Export markets had evaporated. And another large crop was sprouting. Wallace decided to pay farmers to destroy 25% of the crop that was then in the ground. For Wallace, who had spent years perfecting a strain of hybrid corn, and who believed that abundant food supplies were essential for a peaceful world, the thought was almost inconceivable. "To have to destroy a growing crop," he lamented, "is a shocking commentary on our civilization." That August, more than 10 million acres of cotton were plowed under. But what came next was even more difficult. Wallace still had to deal with an abundance of hogs. On the advice of hog farmers, Wallace supported a program of slaughtering 6 million baby pigs weighing under 100 pounds, approximately half the normal 200-pound market weight of adults. Critics lambasted Wallace's pig infanticide and pig birth control. Wallace retorted, Doubtless, it is just as inhumane to kill a big hog as a little one. To hear them talk, you would have thought that pigs are raised for pets. Wallace made sure that some good came from this program. He distributed 100 million pounds of pork, lard, and soap to needy Americans. Not many people realized how radical it was, he reflected. This idea of having the government buy from those who had too much in order to give to those who had too little. Wallace's much-maligned policies produced the desired effect. The price of cotton doubled. Farm income jumped by 30% in 1 year. Still, Wallace regretted the unfortunate message such policies sent. The plowing under of 10 million acres of cotton in August 1933 and the slaughter of 6 million little pigs in September 1933 were not acts of idealism in any sane society. They were emergency acts made necessary by the almost insane lack of world statesmanship during the period from 1920 to 1932. Wallace's clarifications notwithstanding, the seemingly wanton destruction of crops and livestock in the midst of hunger and poverty turned people's empty stomachs and saddled the New Deal with an image of callousness and a reputation of espousing a philosophy of recovery through scarcity. Overall, as Arthur Schlesinger Jr. later wrote, Wallace was a great Secretary of Agriculture. In time, he widened his concern beyond commercial farming to subsistence farming and rural poverty. For the urban poor, he provided food stamps and school lunches. He instituted programs for land use planning, soil conservation, and erosion control. And always, he promoted research to combat plant and animal diseases, to locate drought-resistant crops, and to develop hybrid seeds in order to increase productivity. During his 8 years as Secretary of Agriculture, Wallace not only solidified his reputation as one of the New Deal visionaries on domestic policy, he carved credentials as an outspoken anti-fascist. In 1939, he lent his support to the American Committee for Democracy and Intellectual Freedom, ACDIF. The ACDIF had been organized by Franz Boas, America's leading anthropologist, and like-minded left-leaning scientists earlier that year. In late 1938, Boas released his Manifesto on Freedom of Science. Signed by 1,284 scientists, it condemned Nazi racism and treatment of scientists and teachers, and urged a vigorous defense of democracy and intellectual freedom in the United States. Scientists held Wallace in high regard, considering him the most scientifically literate member of the Roosevelt administration and the scientific community's best ally. They invited him to participate in an October 1939 ACDIF panel discussion on how the scientist can help combat racism at the New York World's Fair. Wallace defined racism as the attempts of individuals in certain groups to dominate others through the building up of false racial theories in support of their claims. Drawing on his background in plant genetics, he focused on the role that scientists can play in combating such false theories and preventing the use of these theories for the destruction of human liberty. He appealed to scientists to lead the fight for the combating of racism. Before it sinks its poison fangs deep in our body politic, the scientist has both a special motive and a special responsibility. His motive comes from the fact that when personal liberty disappears, scientific liberty also disappears. His responsibility comes from the fact that only he can give the people the truth. Only he can clean out the falsities in our colleges, our high schools, and our public prints. Only he can show how groundless are the claims that one race, one nation, or one class has any God-given right to rule. Now, with European democracy on life support, Roosevelt demanded a champion of freedom and democracy as his running mate. But party bosses and party conservatives opposed Wallace for the very reasons Roosevelt wanted him. They feared his radical views. They mistrusted his devotion to principles over politics. It looked as though the Wallace nomination would go up in flames. Roosevelt, angry and frustrated, wrote a remarkable letter to the assembled delegates, a letter of which contemporary Democrats would be wise to take heed, in which he flatly turned down the presidential nomination. He explained, "The Democratic Party must champion progressive and liberal policies and principles. The party has failed when it has fallen into the control of those who think in terms of dollars instead of human values. Until the Democratic Party shakes off all the shackles of control fastened upon it by the forces of conservatism, reaction, and appeasement, it will not continue its march to victory. The Democratic Party cannot face in both directions at the same time. Therefore, I decline the honor of the nomination for the presidency." Eleanor Roosevelt saved the day. The first wife of a nominee ever to address a convention, she told disgruntled delegates that, "We face now a grave and serious situation," and reminded them that this was no ordinary time. Under intense pressure, the party bosses, who dominated the nominating process, and the convention delegates buckled and put Wallace onto the ticket. They would, however,